Today on the Inland Journal podcast, we examine the purity culture. That's the movement whereby unmarried but committed couples agree to stay sexually pure until they take their vows. Journalist Tracy Simmons from Spokane Faith and Values, or Spokane Faves, joins us to interview Janine Warrington, who has written about the purity culture.
Janine, would you mind talking a little bit about yourself? So you graduated from Gonzaga, which is where I met you. And now what are you doing and how are you involved with Spokane Faves?
Right. So I graduated from Gonzaga in 2017 with a degree in religious studies. And now I'm getting my master's in theological studies at Emory University in Atlanta with focuses on Hebrew Bible and sexual ethics. And I've been writing for Faves for a couple of years about those topics mostly. So,
yeah. And what are your ambitions when you graduate?
That's not a fair question. I don't know.
You don't know. Yeah. But you've always had this deep interest in theology, and you write a lot about evangelical issues, but maybe from a different perspective, I would say. Is that fair?
Yeah. I grew up in an evangelical church and still love it, but also have a lot of issues with it. So it's kind of a foot in both camps sort of perspective.
And we asked you to come in today because you've written a couple of columns recently, and one we haven't even published yet, actually, about kind of the issues that are happening about the abortion ban and so forth across the country. So before we dive into that, can you explain a little bit about what purity culture is?
So purity culture is a term used to refer to a set of attitudes and beliefs and teachings and practices surrounding quote-unquote sexual purity, which is remaining abstinent outside of heterosexual marriages, that was especially prevalent in the 1990s and early 2000s in American evangelical churches. But it's still very much alive today. It's just not quite as big of a thing as it was when there were purity rings and purity balls were, you know, all over the place.
Did you say purity balls?
Yeah, where, yeah, you know, a dad would take his daughter to a ball to remind her that, you know, he's her man until she's married, so.
Okay. I'm going to date myself here, but I grew up in the era of the purity ring, so I remember that very well. I don't have it anymore, but. So you've written about the modesty message that's kind of part of all this. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, one of the elements that's really common in purity culture and purity teachings is the idea that modesty is very important, particularly for young women, because you don't want to cause men to stumble by wearing something that's too tight or a skirt that's too short that's going to send off sexual vibes, which is highly problematic because, one, it implies that men have no control over their own sexual urges, and two, it sets up women for victim blaming if anything happens to them. It sets you up for the first question to be, well, what were you wearing, when that really is not the issue when sexual violence happens.
And there have been some faith leaders who have spoken against this, like Nadia Bolz-Weber and others. Any that you're looking at or reading these days?
Yeah, there's a slew of books that have come out recently. I've read some passages from Diana E. Anderson's book Damaged Goods from 2010, I think. Nadia Bolz-Weber's that you mentioned came out earlier this year. I read the whole thing. It's great, but it's also very Nadia, so she has a lot of attitude. And I'm currently working through Linda K. Klein's book Pure from a couple of years ago.
Okay. And what are you learning from these texts?
The one I'm reading right now is a lot of interviews. Linda K. Klein spent 12 years interviewing people that grew up in evangelical churches similar to hers. And so it's a lot of personal stories about the ways that these teachings affected, these women. She's speaking primarily to women, and their attitudes and feelings towards themselves and towards sex and the shame that comes with any sexual behaviors or thoughts or feelings. So, a lot of just personal stories to highlight the sorts of facts that we already know.
Yeah. Shame is an interesting term that you use because that is so powerful, and it carries with you forever, you know, for a long time into other relationships and so forth.
Yeah.
Abstinence-only education is still being taught in some schools and in a lot of churches.
Yes.
What do you think the effects are of that?
I think that for churches, if your understanding of scripture is that abstinence is the right answer outside of marriage, then fine, you can teach that. But what's problematic is when it becomes an excuse not to talk about sex at all. And it feels like evangelical churches talk about sex a lot, but they really just say don't have sex a lot and don't talk about what that means, what sex is, basic anatomy, how to have safe sex. Because even if you believe that you should be abstinent outside of marriage, that's different than a vow of celibacy where you're never going to have sex. You still anticipate that people will be sexually active when they're married, but you're not preparing them for that learning curve from going from complete abstinence to the marriage bed, how to be safe, how to communicate with your partner, which are things that people need to know. And we've also seen that teaching abstinence only before marriage doesn't actually reduce the amount of sex that people are having before marriage in substantive ways, which is why in states like Texas, where that is the primary sex ed in public schools, the teen pregnancy rates are through the roof. So these conversations need to be happening regardless of, you can still promote abstinence, but you still need to be talking about sex.
Need to acknowledge it, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I was a education reporter in Lubbock, Texas for a long time.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was a huge issue. It came up to the school board all the time. Do we continue with this abstinence-only education? And what does this say about the correlation we're seeing in our schools of teen pregnancies?
Yeah. You know? And something else about the public sex ed that drives me crazy is there are only 13 states that mandate that when sex education is taught, it must be medically accurate. And I don't understand why that's not just a federal thing. Like, that should just be the case. But
right.
Yeah.
It's easy to see how this can play into unplanned pregnancy.
Yeah.
So one of the things I appreciate about your columns is you tackle some of the issues that people are afraid to talk about. You write about, you know, the evangelical church and LGBT issues. And lately you've been writing about the abortion bans.
Yeah.
So what was your reaction when this kind of started happening in our country?
Mostly frustration for a variety of different reasons. Obviously, I'm frustrated that there's a lack of access for women in a lot of states now, or when these laws become effective, there will be. But I'm also frustrated that people who have been personally affected by having to make a decision about abortion, that their voices aren't leading the conversation, that they're fighting to have to be heard when they should be the first people that we listen to when making these decisions. I'm also frustrated at our inability to separate church and state. When Governor Kay Ivey signed the Alabama bill into law, she said something to the effect of, you know, this stands as a testament to Alabamians' belief that every life is a sacred gift from God, and used explicit religious language in this public setting, which should not be the case. And then I'm also frustrated that aside, if you are going to use God and the Bible and church history to support something, you should know what the Bible says about that topic and what church teachings have been on that topic, because there's not really any firm biblical support for banning access to abortions.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a tough one, right? This is such a passionate topic for people. So how do we have these conversations that will be less divisive?
That's a great question. I think one thing that we need to do is acknowledge that this is not a black and white issue. It's a really complex issue, which is one of the reasons I think it is so divisive, because it's not just pro-choice versus pro-life. It's life starts at conception versus life starts with the heartbeat versus life starts at birth. And it's there should be no exceptions versus there should be exceptions if the mother's health is threatened versus there should be exceptions for rape and incest versus a woman should have access no matter what her reasons are. And so there are a ton of different positions that you can be on. But that also means that there's a lot more common ground than we give credit to. And we need to acknowledge that pro-life and pro-choice are not mutually exclusive stances. And there are ways that you can be both and reduce rates of abortion, reduce the need for abortion by passing other legislation, like making adoption more accessible to same-sex couples that want to adopt, and making contraception more available to people, better sex education that would help prevent unplanned pregnancies, these sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We have a long road ahead, don't we?
Yeah.
What's your prayer for all of this? Like, what's your prayer for policymakers and maybe the women who live in these states right now who are struggling with this issue?
Yeah. In a word, my prayer would just be help. God, we need your help. For policymakers, humility, to listen to people with different perspectives than them, and humility to say, I might not agree with my constituents, but my job is not to impose my beliefs on my constituents, it's to represent them well. And if the people want access to health clinics and abortion clinics, then I need to make that available, to have the humility to say that. For the people who are dealing with the decision of whether to have an abortion and how to get access to it and how to afford it, courage and patience and the will to keep fighting, even though it's going to be really, really hard. And then also for churches to take the opportunity to step up and to be a place that provides help to people that may not have it through the state, to talk about sex more in meaningful and helpful ways, to be a place where people who have experienced sexual violence to be able to go and confide and not be shamed for it. Churches should be at the forefront of that.
Let me ask you another question. So you're in Spokane for the summer.
Yes.
Washington, Governor Inslee has a very different view, I think, than the Georgia governor on this issue.
Yeah.
What are the conversations like in Georgia right now about this?
I was leaving Georgia just as, I think I flew out the same day that the heartbeat bill passed there. Mm-hmm. So I've been a little bit separated from it, but I know that there are a lot of on campus at Emory where I am. There's a lot of frustration and a lot of vocal feelings. Also being a Methodist school, and the UMC recently passed the saying that you cannot officiate a same-sex wedding as a minister, and you also cannot be an ordained minister if you openly identify as LGBTQ. So there's already a lot of political feelings at this Methodist seminary that I'm going to, and now with the abortion bill passing in Georgia, there's just a lot of feelings all over the place.
I can imagine. What a fascinating time to be in seminary, though.
Yeah.
So we have one more column that you haven't published yet, but can you give our reader, our listeners kind of a clue on what they can expect?
Yeah, I kind of did a summary of it earlier when we were talking about how there's not a clear distinction between pro-life and pro-choice, and give a few different suggestions of what sorts of legislation could be passed to reduce the need for abortion that is both pro-life and pro-choice. You don't have to be anti-choice in order to be pro-life.
Janine Warrington is a Gonzaga alum who is now pursuing theological studies at Emory University in Atlanta. She spoke with Tracy Simmons from Spokane Faves. You can find the Inland Journal podcast by searching for Inland Journal in Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or Google Play, or you can find it on the Inland Journal page of the Spokane Public Radio website. Send your comments and story ideas to inlandjournal@kpbx.org. I'm Doug Nadvornik. Thank you for listening to our program.